It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Coming up, a look at the 45th anniversary of Sesame Street and how it's changed with the times to meet the needs of kids from different backgrounds.
First, we're getting a preview of a new series from the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team called Under the Influence. The series takes a hard look at the alcohol culture in Wisconsin. Pieces will be running all week in Gannett papers.
Shireen Seward is with us now to talk about Wisconsin's alcohol culture. She's an investigative reporter for Gannett in Wisconsin, and she's the author of many of the pieces in this series. Shireen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, a lot of the focus in the series is on drunk driving. And a big question here in Wisconsin is, why do we have such a drunk driving problem? What kind of answers did you hear to that question?
Well, I certainly don't think there are any easy answers to that question, but Wisconsin is unique in a number of ways. The series really took a look at Wisconsin and compared it to other states in the Midwest and found some interesting things. We are the only state in the nation where first-time OWI offenses are not a crime. It's a traffic ticket here. Everywhere else, it's at least a misdemeanor. And the penalty structure here for OWI offenses, repeat offenses, is much different than in neighboring states. Iowa, for example, treats most third offenses as felonies. Illinois and Michigan, same thing. Here it's not a felony until the fifth offense. And here, even the most egregious offenders, we're talking about people with 12, 13, 14 offenses, can get their license back after 3 years. That's also unique to Wisconsin.
And there's been a lot of talk about the culture of drinking and driving in Wisconsin. Are we hearing that maybe this that law enforcement angle of it, the lighter penalties, is sending a message to Wisconsinites that this isn't a big thing?
Perhaps. And there does seem to be a resistance to changing the policies. There will be a piece coming up Thursday with assistance from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism in Madison. They put together a piece about legislative issues that have come before our state lawmakers that have not passed. They've not even come up for a vote in many cases because there is that resistance. And drinking and driving is so ingrained in Wisconsin's culture. We really celebrate our drinking heritage here. And you know, a first-time offense carries surprisingly little stigma compared to other offenses, like shoplifting, for example. It's very unique.
And what's driving the resistance to changes in the law? There's talk about different lobbies, including the Tavern League. Do they seem like a big player when these laws come up to be passed?
You know, I can't speak for the Tavern League, but I can say that there's always been a lot of debate about changing the rules. Sobriety checkpoints, if we can take that for example, mm-hmm. These are commonly used in other states, including Illinois. They're illegal here, and they're quite controversial, not just with lawmakers, but with people, the people here. Many people believe that sobriety checkpoints could violate their rights, they send the wrong message, and they're very expensive. The Tavern League, I know, does not support sobriety checkpoints. Rather, they would rather see more roving patrols. They think they're more effective. But yet, sobriety checkpoints have been very effective in the states that use them, according to national transportation safety figures. So it's really hard to know what it's going to take to make sure that people are getting the message and that the culture changes here.
Now, you mentioned a Neenah police chief who put some kind of voluntary sobriety checkpoint in an agenda, didn't do it. Mm-hmm. What kind of reaction did he get even to floating that idea?
Swift and severe. The backlash was almost immediate. People were very upset, not just in Wisconsin. There were bloggers talking about it all over the country, and obviously it did not go through. But Kevin Wilkinson is the police chief that you're talking about, and he's going to be one of the people that will be with us on Thursday night for a community discussion to talk about some of these possible solutions to the problem of repeat drunken driving in Wisconsin. And one of the things that I know that we'll be talking about is whether sobriety checkpoints are a good idea for Wisconsin or not.
What other kind of topics are you going to tackle at this panel?
The panel will We have a judge, a treatment specialist, a psychology professor. We have the head of the Brown County OWI Task Force. We have a victim of a crash. And we have a repeat offender among the list of panelists. They're going to take questions from the community. And we'll also be talking about some maybe different ideas. One of the things that we're going to be talking about is a gentleman by the name of John Schaus, who told his story to us. He's an 8-time offender who's managed to stay sober now. He's a success story, and his story will be coming up later in the week. He is on the panel, and he wants to propose something as simple as graphic images that are placed in a brochure and put in everybody's driver's license application forms or registration forms. He just has, you know, some very unique ideas. That'll be one of several things that we'll be talking about. And perhaps the lack of treatment programs for folks to take advantage of, as well as public transportation. It'll really run the gamut.
You also profile a 12-time OWI offender who's not a success story, and you talk to people on the prosecution side. A general trend seems to be the people who are offending again and again don't really see themselves as committing a crime or doing anything wrong that merits punishment.
That certainly was the case with our 12-time offender. He was a Manitowoc man who was halfway through a 7-year prison term for his 12th offense, and he is one of the lucky ones. He didn't kill anyone. He didn't hurt anyone physically, but he really has a hard time seeing drinking and driving as a crime. He grew up with it, as many people in Wisconsin did. You know, he and his family went camping. They did a lot of things as a family, and drinking was involved a lot. And he just grew up thinking, well, my dad did it. My family does it. It must be okay if I'm not hurting anybody. And so the question is, how do you reach these people then? How do you make sure they get the message? And if they don't, how do you keep them off the road?
And it was very easy, he told you, to keep getting access to cars even after, you know, 5, 8, 10 offenses.
Yes, and you know, and that's another thing too. He could still register a vehicle in Wisconsin because an OWI offense is not tied to registration for a number of reasons. But yes, it was easy for him to gain access to a vehicle. So it's hard to know if you put these restrictions on these people, will they make a difference? Will they matter? Or will they just find another way around it?
And transportation is another issue that comes up. You at least touch on it in your piece. People have no other way to get from a place they've been drinking to get home at night. Is this something that people are talking about, maybe at your panel coming up on Thursday?
It is. It is a situation that many people face. In other countries, in very urban areas, public transportation is more readily available, and people can actually go out for the evening without even having to take a car. I had a caller today who talked to me about in Scotland, for example, is very, very different. The attitudes are very different. Because they have that public transportation, fewer people are tempted to make those wrong choices. And here in Wausau, where I'm located, bus service ends pretty early. So those are things that matter to people. And our 8-time offender, who will be on the panel, specifically has decided that he will not get a driver's license again, even though he can. He's decided he doesn't want to take the chance that he's going to have that 2,000-pound bullet in his driveway if something happens. So he said to me that living in a place where there's good public transportation makes a huge amount of difference to him and to many other people.
You've talked to people for this series on all sides of this drinking and driving issue. Have you gotten a sense that people feel like, hey, we're finally hitting a point where we're going to make some progress on this and start moving the needle?
I think so. I think that attitudes are changing about drinking and driving. Certainly, there have been changes in legislation that have been successful. A couple of years ago, some significant changes in the law really toughened things up. And people are starting to hear it. They're starting to hear that message. But not everybody is. So it's going to take some work. We certainly have a lot of work to do, But I do think that these kinds of discussions can make a difference.
Shireen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Shireen Seiwert. She's an investigative reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team, with us to talk about the upcoming series Under the Influence.
On this day 45 years ago, a little-known children's television show premiered featuring lovable puppets ranging from a giant yellow talking bird to a green furry trash can living curmudgeon named Oscar.
When it's my birthday, I hope that we get a cold, rainy day so my presents get wet. I'll put some extra fish on my birthday cake and tell all my friends to go jump in the lake. My special way to spend my very special day. And that's the way it's always gonna be. When I say
you can still see your old favorites like Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch, but over the years, Sesame Street has had to adapt to changing times and kids' viewing habits. Today, as we celebrate the show's 45th birthday, it's still popular and it's the longest-running children's television show in U.S. history.
Right now, we're joined by Julie Pullman-Tynan, professor and chair of Human Development and Family Studies at the UW-Madison, and she served as an advisor for Sesame Street. Julie, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, children's shows, you know, they come and go over the years, but Sesame Street has been a classic all these years, and kids are still watching it. How come?
I think because Sesame Street has done a wonderful job changing with the times. They've really tried to update what they do. Every year they look at the research about where kids are with their school readiness and other kinds of things. And then they also look at current events and what's happening in the world. And they try to develop new characters that kind of fit with the changing profile of kids. They offer new ways of viewing the show, and they develop content that's really responsive to kind of what kids are experiencing in our country and around the world, because they are really global.
What are a couple of the ways that the show looks different now than it did, say, 40, 45 years ago?
Sure. Well, they start with the same theme song, but it's a lot jazzier, and it has a lot of different images that are reminiscent of sort of like hip-hop and, you know, a little bit more modern urban culture. There are characters that have stayed the same. You know, they obviously still have the Muppets, and as you mentioned, like Oscar and Big Bird and Ernie and Bert, but there are new characters that have been developed as well. So there's Elmo, who came around, you know, in the 1980s, and there are different ones as well, like Abby Cadabby, who has an interesting backstory. She has divorced parents. There are new characters that are developed for special initiatives. Like there's a character called Kami, who is developed. She's HIV positive and is used in their show in Africa. There's another one called Alex, who has a parent who's incarcerated. And they also bring on stars and celebrities and people in popular culture who are, you know, with the times. So Michelle Obama has been on recently, Usher, Ricky Gervais, you know, other musical stars who keep it sort of up to date. And the appeal isn't just to kids, it's also to the parents, which I think is important as well, because if, you know, parents sometimes control their kids' viewing habits, and if there's something that's going to entertain and be appreciated by a parent, even if a three-year-old doesn't get it, that ends up being really important for its longevity.
Well, you know Sesame Street pretty well, in part because you served as an advisor on the Sesame Street workshop. What are some of the things that you worked on with the show?
So I was an advisor and still am on their resilience initiative. And what they did is based on different research that's been conducted is decide to focus on children's strengths, especially kids who are experiencing challenges like living in low-income urban areas. And so they focus on a number of different issues like divorce, bullying, parental incarceration. And so over the last 4 years, been able to help them develop content regarding parental incarceration, because that's one of the things I study. And then also we've been disseminating the materials for about a year now. And I'm also doing research, like I'm doing a randomized controlled trial in Wisconsin and Minnesota to test the efficacy of the materials. And they are a very research-based organization, so they often partner with academics. And, you know, Wisconsin has sort of a history with that. And just a couple years ago, People in the Comm Arts Department did a meta-analysis looking at the impact of Sesame Street across the world. And then we also have faculty who've consulted on their efforts to promote peace in Palestine and develop a show specifically targeting kids in that region.
These are tall orders for a kids' TV show with Muppets on it. Does it really make a difference? Does it help build resilience for kids?
Yeah, actually. And it's the most extensively researched TV show that exists. And not every single study shows positive results, but by and large, the results of long-term longitudinal studies, meta-analyses, etc., find positive effects for kids. And so one example of this is at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, they did a study following kids. They initially looked at them when they were watching Sesame Street between the ages of 2 to 5 years old, and then they followed them into high school and even found effects of watching Sesame Street on high school outcomes like academic achievement, the time they spent reading, et cetera. Worldwide studies have shown positive effects not only on cognitive development, including literacy and numeracy, but also on knowledge about the world, health and safety, and how the kids have attitudes towards people who are different from them. So in a lot of different areas, it shows positive effects. And it is a tall order, but they've reached pretty high.
And part of this is that Sesame Street doesn't seem to be afraid to go to places that are difficult, that may not seem like the easiest terrain for kids' programming. You talked about the HIV character and children of divorce and incarcerated parents. And another of these that was pretty relevant at the time, especially on the East Coast, was dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. And we have a clip from that episode. This is Big Bird getting coming to terms with the fact that his nest has been destroyed after this hurricane, and Snuffleupagus coming up to try to comfort him.
Oh, why do you feel sad, Snuffy?
Because the hurricane messed up your beautiful home, Bird.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I feel sad, too. My nest, my home.
Say, Big Bird. Where does this phone go?
Oh, it used to be on that post right there.
Right there? Oh, okay.
Thanks, Gordon.
Gosh, Bert, you sure do have a lot of friends helping you clean up.
Yeah, they are fixing it all up for me.
Hey, Bert, that makes me feel happy.
Really?
Yeah, even though the hurricane blew away your nest, it didn't blow away your friends.
That's true, Snuffy.
So how do you thread the needle here, not freaking kids out about a natural disaster and yet dealing with it honestly and working through it like that?
Yeah, it is a balance. And I think one of the reasons that Sesame Street has been so effective is that kids see Muppets as other kids, but adults script them. And so they can, you know, unlike the usual 5-year-old or 6-year-old, the Muppets say things that are very supportive and sensitive and from a child's point of view. And another reason that they're so effective is that they also really consider parents. And so they have lots and lots of materials available for parents and messages for parents of how they can support their children, because they recognize that in the end, it's the parents' role that's so absolutely critical for children's emotional and social development and learning, that they really give parents some tools in order to sensitively talk about really difficult topics like natural disasters and how kids might feel about that and how, even though it's scary, they still can get support and kind of build their life back together.
And is that part of the appeal and maybe the ratings as well, is that parents want to watch it? It's not just that it's something that seems good and positive for their kids, but they themselves want to watch it.
I think a lot of parents do. I know, well, I was 2 when Sesame Street was developed, and so I watched it through my childhood. But then as a parent, I also really enjoyed seeing, you know, who they were going to have as guests, and I got the little inside jokes better than when I was 3. But also I think that watching some really positive, diverse adults interact with the Muppets and other kids on the show is great for role modeling. And so parents do want to watch it, but they also, I think, you know, kind of everybody thinks Muppets are really cute and fuzzy and adorable. And so there's just a general appeal and goodwill. And Muppets can say things that they can say things that human beings can't in a way that's so appealing and supportive.
We're celebrating the 45th anniversary of Sesame Street and talking about how the show fits into the world of children's programming today.
And we'd love to hear from you. Did you watch the show growing up, or do you watch it now with your kids? How important was the show to your childhood or to your parenting? Have you seen it evolve over the years? Do you think it's still relevant for children?
Hi, Elmo's here with his good friend, Mr. LL Cool J.
Hey, what's up? We're about to go on an audition expedition. Want to come?
An audition expedition? What's that?
That's when you add them up. Let's go on an audition expedition. You don't have to be a mathematician.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about Sesame Street and how it's changed over time, evolved, as the show marks its 45th birthday today.
And you can join the conversation. Did you watch the show growing up, or do you watch it now with your kids? How important was it to you and to your children? And who are some of your favorite Sesame Street characters? Have you seen the show change and adapt over the years? Is it still relevant, do you think? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us a tweet at CentralTimeWPR.
We're talking with UW-Madison professor Julie Pullman-Tynan, and she served as an advisor for the Sesame Street workshop. Well, Julie, one way that a lot of media have changed over the times is to adapt to the world of the internet. How is Sesame Street done as far as that goes?
I think they've done fabulously, and it's one of the reasons that they've stayed popular is that you don't just see them on TV. Most kids actually watch them through the internet or through an app or through YouTube. And so they've become way more interactive. They have extensive web presence through PBS Kids and then their own website, and I think that they've just become really rolled with the times and adapted new technologies to what they do.
Are there any significant challenges to Sesame Street going forward that the show, you know, it's been around for a long time and it has reinvented itself, but what does it need to look out for?
Some parents have said that their kids aren't as interested in it because it might focus on topics that, you know, are kind of old news or passé, but I think that that's not the norm. It is the most watched television show in the world. I think that continuing challenges will be to keep sort of a pulse on where young kids and their parents are. And so I think they try to do this by always bringing in new content, new advisors, new people. So, for example, they recently brought on their first American Indian live adult character. They've had some of the same ones over time, and they continue to try to be diverse, represent the cultures that they're in, and try to, you know, respond to current events. I think those are really key.
And how about all the competition now? There's such a fragmented media landscape. There are whole channels with cartoons or shows for kids. Has that been a problem for Sesame Street?
I think it's been a challenge in some ways, but a lot of these other shows end up being modeling themselves on Sesame Street and how they do it. And so I think they've just been such a trailblazer, and they're such a research-based developed organization that it's not really serious competition and that they'll go away. It's actually good, and that they've had a widespread effect on what kind of media can help children.
Let's take a caller now. Martha joins us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Martha.
Hi.
What do you think?
I was calling because I'm a kindergarten teacher in Sun Prairie, and I grew up watching Sesame Street, and I personally don't like the newer ones. Like, I like the old classic stuff. But I do play the old classic clips. Like, when we're learning a letter, I'll play, like, the Sesame Street podcast for that letter of the day. And it has a lot of the old things. Like, kids just love, like, the old number ones with, like, the guy who, like, he's like, I'm going to paint a 7. And then he goes around and paints, like, a 7 on the back of somebody's head or something. And
How do your kids like it?
They love it because the things I play from these clips are, the clips that I'll play for them off of YouTube are like the old ones, and they just think they are hilarious, and they think they're so different, and they wonder what that is. And it's something I think that it's nice because it seems so wholesome or something. Like, they're 5 and 6 years old and they are excited. You know, it is TV and you think, well, I don't want them watching that much TV, but at least it's something where they, like one of their favorite songs right now is this Belly Breathe song that Elmo sings with Common and like, I can't remember, the, some girl. And like, it's about how you calm down when you're feeling mad. And
so some useful stuff there for kids even today. Thank you so much, Martha, for that. And it sounds like her students still like it. And she is a fan of the older Sesame Street, not as much the newer. I wonder if that's a generational thing. If you grow up with Sesame Street a certain way, that's the way you want it to be.
It could be. But the video that she points to focusing on self-regulation skills, that's actually one of the
Elmo's newer
ones. Elmo's newer,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So maybe she likes both and she doesn't realize it.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Bob with us in Madison. Bob, hi.
Hi there. My understanding is that one of the original goals of Sesame Street was to close the achievement gap. And I'm wondering if that recently is still the case. And if so, how is if that's being attained?
Bob, interesting. And a big issue here in Wisconsin, Julie.
So it is true that one of Sesame Street's original goals was to particularly target kids who were in low-income communities where they had less opportunities for enriched early educational experiences. And the studies that have generally focused on kids' cognitive outcomes have found that there is a positive effect of watching Sesame Street on things like vocabulary development and other cognitive outcomes. And so it really isn't just about watching TV or not TV. It's about watching educational shows like Sesame Street that are really helping. But what we're also finding now is that about 50% of kids are not ready for school in the areas of social emotional learning and self-regulation and executive functioning, which is like planning ahead and paying attention and those kinds of things. And so now Sesame Street is trying to sort of change directions and try to focus more on those kinds of learning skills where there's still definitely very large gaps in achievement based on race and ethnicity.
Do people still think that Sesame Street has legs to go forward many years? It's been on 45 years is a long time for any TV show, you know, let alone, you know, this, it's kind of a cute, like she said, wholesome notion based on some of what you see there. Do you see it continuing for a long time into the future?
Oh, I do. And I think that Sesame Workshop is basically making plans to do that because they introduce new characters, new themes, new technologies, and they have characters that just continue even when the people who originated in the role, for example, like the Kevin Clash, the person who started Elmo, no longer does Elmo, but Elmo survives and Elmo goes on and someone else does him. Same with, you know, some of the other ones like Grover and Cookie Monster. And there's something about Muppets that's timeless. And so I think they do plan on going forward. And I really do think that there's an appeal that can go on for generations. And actually, one time I was talking with Bob, one of the original people characters on Sesame Street, and he says yes, they know they are having a generational effect because people who grew up with it want their kids to know that part of their childhood, and then grandparents now, and they call those sesame seeds. So they believe they plant them and that they will continue to thrive.
You mentioned earlier resources available for parents beyond the TV show. Does Sesame Street Workshop reach out with, I don't know, curricula for schools or reach out into communities? How do they do that, if so?
Yeah, they reach out in a number of different ways. They've actually developed what they call toolkits for a number of different organizations and issues. And so they've worked extensively with the U.S. military to develop toolkits for kids whose parents are in the military. And it also led to work with helping develop materials for parents and when kids are grieving the loss of a parent. And then they also have different curricula that you can either get online or as an app that can help both teachers, homeschoolers, and other kinds of educators working with young children on just basic things like letters, numbers, social-emotional development, those kinds of things.
So, Julie, you're a Sesame Street fan, along with being an advisor. Do you have a favorite moment over the years?
My favorite character is Grover, and my favorite scene is Super Grover when he flies around and then crashes into things. It's very funny.
That's a good one.
All right. Well, Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking about Sesame Street's 45th birthday. You can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. You've been hearing Julie Pullman-Tynan. She's a professor and chair of human development and family studies at the UW-Madison. It's time for Wisconsin Life. The world marks the 100th anniversary of the First World War this year. More than any other war, World War I is associated with the poetry of the men who served. Today we share a poem written by Byron H. Comstock, a Marine from Portage. Wounded twice in battle, Comstock started writing poems while recovering in a hospital.
I see once more the plains of France with her roads of gleaming white, the graves of those who took the chance, the front as it looked at night. Once more I am one of the marching throng, with rifle, mask, and pack, as we trudged along with a low-hummed song to be there at the next attack. The stars that shone from overhead with a solemn sort of gleam, the road that led through that land of dead, 'twas all like a fearful dream. Then the flares shot up without a sound and hung little balls of light, and we lay round on the barren ground and stared into the night. We hiked and hiked on the rim of the pit till it seemed we soon must drop, then rested a bit in the red-hot spit till they sent us over the top. In a gush of lead I see the dead lie crumpled on the ground. By the mine ahead the earth turns red. No hell has such a sound. Creeping low in that land of woe like ants, we play the game. To our death we go and the world will know our price. But not our name. Again I see each lurid day, each new and costly gain, and the battered clay still seems to stay there rotting in the rain. I hear them cry, tonight, relief! In a daze we stagger back. Do we still live? It's beyond belief. Then train for the next attack. That is my dream, and always will be, when I think of those days of care. That's what I see when I doze after tea, at ease in my old armchair.
That was a poem from Wisconsin soldier Byron H. Comstock, read by WPR's own Peter Sobel. This story is part of the Wisconsin Life series, Wisconsin in the First World War. Go to wisconsinlife.org to find more stories, as well as photos, posters, letters, and poems.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8:30.
Now, for more on Wisconsin and World War I, we pay a visit to the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. The museum's assistant director, Christine Zicker, joins us here in the studio. Christine, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, we just heard from one Wisconsinite who served in the First World War. Do we know how many people in the state ended up serving ultimately?
We do. Over 118,000 Wisconsinites served in the war, and this included the 32nd Division, which you might have heard of, one of the largest infantry divisions, Wisconsin National Guard, as well as hundreds of nurses who went over and served overseas. So quite a few served, and in fact, at the time, to put it in perspective for you, that's about one out of 21 citizens of the state, so quite a significant number.
When it comes to the museum, what kinds of exhibits do you have about World War I?
We have an interesting World War I exhibit, and we have, for example, a machine gun that was captured by Clayton Slack. He was a Medal of Honor recipient from the state. We also have a relatively new component to the exhibit, which tells some of the stories from the collection. So this is a touch screen where you can go and see the photos, hear the stories, and really it brings it to life a little more than just a static exhibit.
Well, to take a couple stories from Wisconsin veterans who served during World War I, you mentioned flying ace, Rodney Williams. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Rodney Williams might be the best known Wisconsinite from the state from World War I. He was, as you said, a flying ace. Now, keep in mind, during World War I, aircraft were relatively new. So if you can imagine, the Wright brothers, their first flight was 1903. So, you know, only a bit over a decade later, you have people going into warfare in planes. And so Rodney Williams was flying a Sopwith Camel, which is a biplane. And we have some of his items in the collection, and he has great stories. He was a real daredevil. He at one point took bullet fire in his plane, and he was able to basically plug the holes with his fingers and turn around and bank back to his base. So he's really a phenomenal Wisconsin story from the war. He's not the only one by far, but certainly one of the more dramatic ones.
And I think you had said he had taken out something like four planes.
That's correct. He's credited, I believe it was four planes and a balloon. So he earned the title of ace with those accomplishments.
And as you said, there were women who served as nurses during this war. And among them, there was a nurse from Madison.
That's right. Helen Belofsky is one of the nurses who served. There were hundreds from the state, and there were thousands overall. There were about 10,000 women serving in Europe before the end of the war. Helen was from Madison and ended up going into nursing school out of high school and served at Base 22, which was a hospital over in France. This was not uncommon for women. This is a way they could help the war effort. Certainly women had served before this time, but this was really the first monumental effort by women in the armed forces. And if you can imagine, these nurses were dealing with everything from mustard gas, shrapnel, and near the end of the war, a pretty serious flu epidemic, which actually killed more people than World War I itself.
And did they get the recognition that their counterparts, their male counterparts, got in World War I?
That's a good question. Probably not, but that's part of what we hope to do, is to bring those stories to life. We do also have Helen Belofsky's material in the collection, and we make sure to point out to people that women did serve. So that's an interesting chapter of our history that many people don't know.
World War I is known as a war of technology. What is meant when people talk about that?
It is certainly a war of technology, and what they mean is there were so many new inventions that came about around the time of World War I. This can include anything from, as we talked about, flight itself to machine guns. Machine guns were never used, you know, in a war to this magnitude. Tanks were new. So all of these new inventions really changed the face of warfare. So World War I has been referred to during the time as the war to end all wars. Of course, we know that, sadly, that wasn't the case. But at the time, it was a global phenomenon that really most countries had never seen a war on that scale.
And in terms of the casualties, in the numbers from Wisconsin, do we know how many made it back home?
Well, we know that about 1,800 were killed from this state. Some of them were buried in Europe, and this is an interesting issue as well. Most Americans did not want to leave their wounded or their military dead overseas, but that is what happened in some cases. And there were about 8,000 casualties overall from Wisconsin.
Now, we began listening to that poem from a Wisconsin veteran named Byron H. Comstock. Listening to that, did anything strike you based on the exhibits and the stories, the letters that you've seen at the museum?
I think, as you mentioned, the poetry surrounding the war, not only literary works, but visual imagery, I think everyone can imagine the field of poppies from World War I, and that's one of these powerful images. So I think it really struck home sort of this powerful emotional reaction to this war at the time. This was something they had never imagined before.
Would you say that World War I gets less attention than World War II? It seems as though, well, obviously World War II is more recent and had some very charismatic figures involved in that. Does World War I get the recognition that it deserves?
It probably doesn't. And part of that is because we have World War II veterans who are still alive and able to tell their stories, although, of course, we're losing them quickly as well. World War I, obviously, we don't know anyone who lived during that time. And so that's part of the function the museum tries to serve. We do have an oral history collection with World War I veterans, which is amazing. And just overall, I think World War II is a bigger effort. More people were mobilized. More people were involved on a social level as well. And so I think sometimes World War I seems very ancient to us, but it really wasn't that long ago, only 100 years.
Is there anything that strikes you that you want people to know as assistant director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum that you want people to take away when they think about the creation of Veterans Day and about the sacrifices of World War I?
Yeah, many people don't realize that Veterans Day does date back to World War I. Of course, the war ended on November 11th, which eventually became Veterans Day here in the United States. So as we all pause tomorrow and think about Veterans Day, you might recall that it has its roots in World War I, and we can't forget the veterans who served back then as well. This Veterans Day will mark 96 years from the close of the war, and at the Veterans Museum, we're looking forward to 2017 when we'll really launch our exhibits at the museum because of the American involvement at that point.
And for people who may want to visit the museum, what kinds of things would you have to offer visitors and also veterans and people who want to learn more about the history?
Sure. The Veterans Museum is part of Department of Veterans Affairs, and we're right here in Madison on the square. We have free admission, and so we welcome everyone to stop in. We have great exhibits starting from Civil War. Right now we're also wrapping up, starting to look forward to the end of the Civil War next year. And we also have a new exhibit on the War on Terror, which is a more modern exhibit on Iraq and Afghanistan. And in between, we have very good World War I and World War II exhibits, among others. So there's really something for everyone. And it's not just a war museum. Sometimes that's how people think of it. But it's really about the social history of this time and the people who served, but also their families and the people in the communities they left behind.
Christine, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Christine Zicker, Assistant Director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum.